Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. Laureen Jaffe and Mike Deason have a great show for you today, including lots of anti-Semitism updates covering everybody from Chelsea Handler to the Health Department Director of the state of Ohio. You don't want to miss a minute. Just a reminder right now, though, to subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to like and follow the Third Opinion Podcast on Facebook. Now, here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good morning, or good evening, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
Laureen Jaffe.
And this is a pre-recorded program, but if you're listening to it on Sunday, it is Father's Day. So happy Father's Day to everybody who is out there, whether you're listening to this on Sunday or any day of the week. If you're a dad, congratulations.
Well, and my dad is listening, so happy Father's Day.
Oh, very cool.
Of course. Yes, he always listens. So, well, we should just jump right in. We have a lot to report. I mean, obviously, you know, Mike and I will play an interview today as we continue some of the dialogue around reform of the criminal justice system. But sort of going to some of the things related to that this week, you know, obviously as protests continue around the world, you know, we saw some pretty anti-Semitic things happening in France, for instance.
Oh, man.
I mean, you know, so in France, as people are aware, you know, people around the world are coming and supporting George Floyd and the need for reform really globally and addressing racism in a multitude of countries, which is very important. But at the same time, as Mike and I've talked about, a lot of people are using this opportunity to attack Jews. And so, you know, there was a large group of people in the gathering in Paris, you know, shouting slurs of dirty Jews, and accusing Jews of, you know, police violence and creating really the cause again. Yes, blaming Jews for George Floyd's death. I mean, I just you can't make this stuff up. And obviously, President Macron came out with a very strong statement condemning that. But this is what we, you know, see not only here, obviously in the U.S. that we talked about, but globally, like Chelsea Handler playing that clip from Louis Farrakhan and the head of the Nation of Islam. So he, you know, here in the U.S., we've talked about Louis Farrakhan and why he's so nasty. I mean, this man has called Jews satanic. He's, you know, compared us to being termites.
And you do know Chelsea Handler is Jewish.
I know, but what's so amazing about
her? You know, that's what her dad's an Ashkenazi Jew. Her mom was a Mormon, and she chose Judaism. And, I mean, she chose it, and then she plays this Farrakhan.
I know. I mean, she may have chosen it, but I don't know that she, you know, practices openly. But what bothered me probably more than her even playing it was that once, you know, the Simon Wiesenthal Center sent her a text. Like, people were like, look, you know, Chelsea, this is really offensive, and here's why. And even after she was told why this was offensive, she sort of doubled down. And the response was just stupid. I mean, you know, I couldn't even understand what she was trying to explain, you know, to her audience. But she wrote on her Instagram page, she said, well, you know, she defended playing that statement. She says, well, Hitler was responsible for killing millions of lives. Farrakhan is just responsible for his own promotion of anti-Semitic beliefs. They are very different. Do you know what that means? I mean, I have this huge question mark going, what? What did you say, Chelsea? Like, what does that even mean? Like, he's responsible for his own promotion of anti-Semitic beliefs. And I just, like, okay, is that's how you're apologizing for playing a clip by somebody who is so offensive?
Did you see the Hollywood stars that liked the clip? You know how you do a like on Facebook? I mean, Jennifer Aniston, Michelle Pfeiffer, Jessica Chastain, Jennifer Gardner. I mean, maybe they weren't thinking. My hope is, you know, sometimes on Facebook you hit the like and, you know, move on. You don't even think about it. I try to, but I just want to say to them, what is wrong with you? Yeah, Farrakhan, to me, is one of the most dangerous people to Jews in America and throughout the world. I mean, such a blatant anti-Semite. And I don't know what is wrong with him, but he has a huge, huge following, which scares me. It really does.
And just a resounding hatred of Jews. Like, it just, I can't even, like, you just listen to his speeches and it just really sickens you to your core.
You've got to give him, he is an unbelievable speaker that can go for hours and hours and hours. but I mean, so could Castro, so could Hitler. I mean, this guy is very dynamic, which makes him all the more dangerous, it seems to me.
It does. And, you know, so I think this was just a, you know, to follow up last week. I mean, I thought that was really important. You know, another piece of news just here locally in Florida.
FSU? You know,
the student president at Florida State University, I guess he's the Senate president,
right,
has been posting things, or found to have been posting things on his social media, you know, like stupid Jew and F Israel.
Comparing Israel to Nazi Germany is what he was doing. Yeah.
And then when I thought, and by the way, it's like, it's just, there is no comparison. You cannot take one of the most evil men that existed in the world in the last, you know, 200 years, and who had a final solution to annihilate Jews, slaughtered, you know, over 6 million Jews, and then slaughtered people who he thought were just, like, you know, drain on society. If you're a handicapped, if you're elderly, and then also just killed gay and lesbian community. I mean, the man was just a disgusting human being. And then so that's why it's so offensive. But what was interesting is that he then doubled down, and then the Students for Justice in Palestine reacted to the controversy over his social media and said, oh, he's just, these are just racially and politically motivated attacks. This is Islamophobia. And I just thought, this has nothing to do with the guy's religion. I mean, I, like, this is about him being
his
a
hate.
Student leader and violating the hate laws.
And just promulgating hate through his beliefs and all. It has nothing. It's not a religious censoring by people stepping up and saying this is wrong. This is a censoring of hate. No, I mean, I think that there's a real distinction there where people say, well, he should be able to practice his religion. Absolutely, he should be able to practice his religion. But he should not, as a student leader, be promulgating hate.
Exactly, because it violates the conduct code and violates Florida law. Like, you are an example. Why are you out there spreading, you know, lies and hate? So that was his problem. So that's, you know, currently obviously being looked at here in the state of Florida. But, you know, what's also interesting, I thought, you know, we've obviously talked about Mayor de Blasio, yeah. New York City on our show for some of his, you know, questionable statements about the Jewish community. So very interesting this week, a group of Orthodox Jews as well as Catholic priests have now sued the governor and the mayor, calling discrimination, you know, based upon, in essence, you know, the mayor sort of focusing on yeshivas and daycares and within the Orthodox community, and yet, you know, allowing other large groups to gather, including protesters, et cetera, without any crackdown. And they're saying this is discrimination because, by the way, it's the freedom of religion and the right to assemble. These are both constitutional rights. And they're saying, you know, there is blatant discrimination and differences in how you are treating us versus the rest of New York.
Well, you know what makes no sense to me, though? Okay, he wants to be reelected as mayor. You've got a city with one of the highest Jewish populations in the world.
And
that's like running for governor of Utah saying, I hate Mormons. I mean, even if he feels that way, I would think that his political acumen would tell him, maybe, Bill, this is not a good thing to say out loud. You know, it stupefies me that he even thinks this way, which to me makes him not qualified to be garbage collector if he doesn't have enough smarts to say, yeah, this is not a good thing to do when I'm trying to get reelected and it's got such a heavy Jewish population. You know, it makes no sense to me. You know, speaking of hate, did you see the ADL and the NAACP asking people to stop advertising on Facebook for the month of July because Facebook refuses to police hate speech? I don't understand that.
Yeah, and I, you know, I mean, look, Zuckerberg has been very clear in a lot of his statements you know, saying our values are inspired by American tradition, which is more supportive of free expression than anywhere else. You know, at the same time, look, you and I both know, I can go on there right now and find a bunch of Holocaust deniers. I can see, you know, a bunch of different hate speech that's out there
right.
on Facebook. And I, you know, although I was happy to see, at least this week, Facebook removed about 900 accounts linked to white supremacist groups, you know, that were talking about organizing and bringing weapons to some of the peaceful protests that were going on around the country. So at least he did that.
Yeah, but they have really had a bad record of censoring just some, first of all, blatantly false information, and then the hate speech that is running rampant through Facebook. It's distressing. Now let's give Zuckerberg some congratulations. And I'm not a big Zuckerberg fan, but he and his wife are funding a study to look at Jewish genetic diseases that affect Ashkenazi Jews. He contributed a huge amount of money for the research, but to me, it doesn't absolve you of sins when you've got so much money and you do something. But I want to give him credit for that while we're bashing him, but I'm coming down on the bashing side. I am not a Zuckerberg fan.
And I get it. I mean, look, I think all of these social media platforms, it's difficult to manage it and figure out. You know, there's some stuff that's just so obvious. I don't know why it's difficult, but you know, I mean, I had friends who had the Israel flag on their Facebook pages or cover, and they were taken down as being offensive. And
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I could not understand how or why. So let me jump to something else that I thought was really shocking this week. In Germany.
The pig?
Oh, my God. So there's this famous statue at this church in Germany. I think it's the church that's associated with Martin Luther and the Christian reformer. And the statue that is on the church shows a Jewish man suckling on the breast of a pig. And this is, I can't even begin to describe how disgusting.
It is extremely, extremely offensive.
But this is just goes back to that deep-rooted anti-Semitism that existed in the Catholic Church and all over Europe for so. And then you wonder why today there are, you know, obviously the Inquisition, which we talked about, and then the Holocaust, like all these deep-seated beliefs that were there. I mean, to even put something like that out, I mean, it's just like why. Is that I guess they had worked on it and they had put it back up. I don't know.
Yeah, it had been taken down, then it was put back up. I think it's covered right now, and they're planning to uncover it. Is my understanding of that? But what are they thinking? You know, it makes no sense to me. But obviously, to them, it just shows that prejudice runs rampant, and it's not just in the United States; it's in Europe, more so, perhaps than here. But it's frightening how many people just hate Jews.
I had no words for. I really am just speechless that would even be like, why would you even want to put that back up? I don't know. Anyway,
yeah. And
that's just really disturbing.
Okay, and then the Ohio health director, Dr. Amy Acton, had to step down, or she decided to step down after she's Jewish, and she had called for restrictions for the COVID-19, and all of a sudden these anti-Semitic tropes were being published on social media again about her, and she decided it's not worth it, and she stepped down. Because she was doing her job, and then they jumped on her for being Jewish and said it was a Jewish plot. Which
I know. We're responsible for it all. Responsible for everything in the world. So maybe we can. How about we switch? We switch. Oh, I was going to go to Israel and talk about this. I thought this was a great conversation, because you and I started talking about a lot of what was happening between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. So there's a great piece in Al Monitor this week, you know, because obviously the Palestinian Authority had sort of come out publicly about a month ago saying we're officially breaking ties, security ties with Israel. Now, they've had official ties with Israel, you know, for 50 plus years. And this is not the first time Abbas has said it. So, and we had mentioned that some of the Palestinians were really upset about it because they didn't want militias within the Palestinian Authority that's over on the West Bank sort of taking over security operations. But it does turn out, obviously, security is still going on. And people don't understand, it's like when Israelis, the Palestinian Authority security forces and the Shin Bet work very closely together. So when Israeli forces are in the West Bank, you know, if they're arresting a terrorist or doing something, because the Palestinian Authority doesn't want Hamas terrorists in their territory, and they cooperate with Israel. So we saw this week that there was continued cooperation. The security forces are talking about that. There was a raid. They were able to get out a terrorist. You know, and Israel even, in, you know, cooperation with the Shin Bet and the Palestinians, I mean, they even saved Abbas's life when he had a hit on him by Hamas. So there's a lot of people don't understand, like, oh, Israel is always going into the West Bank doing stuff. Well, they're doing it in complete cooperation with the Palestinian Authority. And I just thought I had to point that out because that was a great point. However, they are still refusing, the Palestinian Authority is still refusing the aid from United Arab Emirates.
And that is just amazing. Okay, for those who don't know, United Arab Emirates are sending aid and medical supplies to the Palestinian Authority. The plane has to land in Israel, and then the Palestinian Authority said, well, then we won't accept the help. Come on, guys.
it's just in tons and tons. I mean, it's like over 14 tons of aid. There's 15 ventilators, so... And I think that we reported last week that the news came out that some of it had made it to the Gaza Strip, and the UN says not yet, but they are still working on it, and they're hoping to get, even if the PA doesn't want it, that they're going to get it into Gaza in the next coming days, the ventilators and everything else. So I'm, you know, it just, that's, there's so many weird things that happen over there, but hopefully that aid will get to the people who need it most as soon as possible. And how about this? I thought, since we always talk about movies and shows, there is Saudi Arabia, their news network, Al Arabia, has done a documentary special called Hezbollah's Jihad Narcotics, which I guess comes out this week. So there was a three-piece article, maybe it was in the Politico a couple of years ago, called Project Cassandra, which exposes, so Hezbollah is very active in Latin America and South America, in Colombia, as well as in Venezuela. And
the drug cartels, exactly, yeah. They make a lot of money off of it, yes.
Hundreds of millions, and so this is a big deal when you get this. So, you know, it shouldn't be surprising. They're, you know, a criminal terrorist organization, so I guess they've decided to start profiting. But there's a huge expose. I assume we'd be able to watch it on Al Arabia online, so take a look for it. I mean, I'll be very interested to see how that piece plays out. And get a better understanding of what they're doing.
And speaking of media in Israel, there is a huge controversy right now about a new TV channel called God TV, which is aiming at proselytizing to Jews in Israel to convert to Christianity. And it is causing a major controversy. I have a little clip here from Israeli TV to explain what it's all about. But listen to what they're talking about God TV.
There's no interference in internal affairs of any church or any congregation or any synagogue. However, the message that we got very strongly from God TV was that this broadcasting license that they recently gained was specifically to missionize, to share Jesus with the Jews of Israel. And that is a very touchy question.
It's a platform for local Messianic Jews, for Christian Arabs, and a few international Christian media outlets to be able to share with believers here in Israel, as well as the whole country, who we are as believers in Yeshua.
I think from a Jewish point of view, they look back at 2,000 years of Jewish Christian history. They look back at the Inquisition, forced conversions, the Crusades, and they really feel this pressure of actually the gospel going in Hebrew very much. And that's a lot of the objections, as well as the objections as possible violating Israeli law by proselytizing minors. Shilano says they're not doing that, so that's a big part of the debate right now. But from a Messianic Jewish point of view, they say this is what they should be able to express themselves on this channel.
It is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is interesting. This has been going on for a couple of weeks, and I was reading a lot of things. There's a lot of different opinions. I mean, even there are multiple evangelical leaders that have come out condemning God TV and saying you shouldn't be doing this. And then there I've seen, you know, rabbis saying, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of this. The TV station, I guess, the cable network that did it said they felt like it passed standards. But there is a lot of controversy. And I, you know, there is very vocal on both sides. So it'll be interesting because for those of you who know, in Israel, it is unlawful to proselytize a minor, and someone under the age of 18. So there is a lot of concern around, like, how do you control to make sure that this TV station is not being broadcasted to minors? You know, what happens if parents aren't home and their children are watching TV? So definitely a lot of controversy around that.
Yeah, I don't think we've heard the last of this. I think it will go on. Speaking of crazy things in Israel, though, how about Rabbi Baruch Gazatsky, who says that immodesty by women in Israel is what is causing breast cancer, and he's a member of the Knesset.
And so you know, see, just shows you anyone can become a member of the Knesset. Anyone can run for office. It's just so absurd that like, you know, it's just lack of education, lack of science, lack of, you know, I mean, not to mention that there's a gene genetically, the Ashkenazi Jews genetically have this gene that makes them more prone to breast cancer.
Even if they wear a dress that covers them all the way up to their neck, they're still.
Stupidity. I just don't even know. It's dumb.
I read
but
that.
I guess. Yeah. But how about the good news? How about, I'm really excited about this. So in Canada, which has a very large Jewish population.
Oh, yeah.
So Anami Paul, she's vying to become the first head of the Green Party for the nation of Canada. And she'd be the first Black and first Jewish leader. So the first Black Jewish leader of a major party in Canada. Just really sweet story about her. A nice story sort of going through her life experience in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, if you want to read about it. She had converted to conservative Judaism about 20 years ago. I went through the whole process, you know, the Bet Din, the mikvah, raising her two boys is Jewish. Her husband is a Jewish human rights lawyer. So just a really nice story, but it would be really impactful to see something like that happen in Canada and have her become a leader. I think she could do a lot for, to combat racism and hate.
Right,
in that position.
It was sort of reminiscent. Remember last week we talked about the Jewish Black lesbian rabbi in North Carolina.
Yes, we did.
Who she said, you want to talk about dealing with prejudice? I've got it on all fronts.
Amazing. I know. She's definitely, you know, and I think it makes her a great voice to sort of talk about what it's like to be like that and then how we can confront racism and different things together. So it'll be really interesting. The other thing, I mean, Israel's expecting, You know, with COVID-19, Israel is actually expecting a huge influx. I think the Jewish Agency was saying between 90 to 100,000 right. immigrants in the next year alone, which you have to understand population-wise is huge. Israel's a nation of, you know, 8.5 million people, less than, you know, just not a big population. So that influx is huge. And more importantly, there's, you know, Israel's been bringing in the Jewish community from Ethiopia for years. And then there's one final community left in Ethiopia during COVID-19. Actually, there's a huge flight of people from that community that came in as part of the 5-year immigration plan for this final community called the Falash Mora community in Ethiopia. They were the last community to come in. They were known as the community that was forcibly converted by missionaries in the 19th and 20th centuries to Christianity, but they returned to their Judaism, and so they are now coming in. So I think there's only a few thousand left to be coming in. So really yeah. happy to have that finally completed.
But speaking of COVID-19, the cases are jumping in Israel. There's a real concern. They had it pretty much under control, but was it last week it jumped from 20 to 200 new cases? I mean, that's a tenfold jump, and they are concerned about that in Israel. Whether it's a second wave, or I don't know what's coming home to roost, but it's still that's a real concern to Israeli medical authorities.
It is, and it's something for us to keep an eye out. I mean, they're still trying to figure out, you know, is this significant? Is it not significant? We've increased testing. It looks like the majority of the people who do have tested positive are children who generally don't show symptoms, because we know they've closed a couple of schools. Lots of strong rebukes, reminding people to wear masks when they're outside. So it's still, you know, but statistically, when we looked at sort of the most severe as far as statistically where we are with people back on ventilators and different things, they say it's not statistically significant, I guess. So it'll be interesting to see, since they obviously reopened before we did here in the U.S., to see how they figured out and if they are able to keep it under control. So
hopefully they will. Yeah. But I'm not sure about that. Hey, listen, why don't we do this? We've got an interview coming up with Mike Perotti, who is running against Andrew Warren for state attorney. We had Andrew on, 2 weeks ago, talking about some of the reforms that he wants to do. And we felt that it was important that we provide equal time because it's a political race. So let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back with that interview, okay?
Sounds good.
All right, this is the Third Opinion. Two Jews, three opinions.
An interview with a Florida state attorney candidate on law enforcement and social justice is coming right up. But let me just take a moment to remind you how you can support the Third Opinion podcast. You can make an individual donation. Your company or organization can get its message out on Third Opinion through underwriting. And your business or your organization or you yourself can become members of the Third Opinion Founders Club. Find out more about all of this at thirdopinionpodcast.com. Now, back to Third Opinion.
Welcome back to the Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Jaffe.
Okay. So, as I mentioned before the break, we had Andrew Warren on a couple of weeks ago because so much is going on in our community in terms of racial justice and reforms with police. And Andrew talked a lot about that this week. As a matter of fact, he refused to charge the protesters who were arrested by Tampa police. He said they were protesting peacefully. Mike Perotti, who is running against him, was critical of that. He is a former deputy sheriff in the Hillsborough Sheriff's Office and the counsel for the sheriff's office. And I asked him when we first talked to him, he said, you don't run for an office if you think the guy who's running the office right now is doing a good job, or that you have
right.
differing views. And he admits that he has a lot of different views than Andrew Warren. And
I was going to say, but we should add the Jewish angle so people know why it's on our show.
Oh, yeah. Well, but for a couple of, well, first off, Andrew's Jewish. I mean, and that's why we got him on our show. But we also talk about, you know, the current issues of the day and certainly what is going on in terms of relations between law enforcement and the African American community. I think is as important as the issues because we're all in this together.
I think Andrew even added, like, I think what was important about Andrew's piece, and because as Jews, you know, one of the things that, you know, for those of you who aren't Jewish, you're listening, I mean, as Jews, we're commanded, it's a mitzvah, we're responsible for going out there and pursuing justice and loving mercy, which means you speak out for the oppressed, you know, and to heal them, it says that Hashem, that he will work justice and righteousness for all the oppressed. How does he do that? We have to be that voice. And I think, you know, Andrew, not only is he the state attorney, but he's, you know, he ended his interview with a very specific point of view on how Judaism had a very profound impact on his life and how he moves forward with justice for and operating from a place of mercy as well. And you know, and that I think is really important. And that's why we're having this dialogue, because the Jewish and Black communities, you know, have so much in common historically from the prejudices and the racism. And we need to be a voice for our friends right now who are suffering tremendous injustices.
Okay.
So that's why.
All right. And this again is Mike Perotti, and wanted to know why he's running.
Well, and I guess let me say by the beginning, this isn't about Andrew. I've met Andrew. He and I have talked several times. He's a very nice guy. I think that unlike maybe a lot of other political races, we agree on a great number of things. I think what it comes down to is the implementation and the devil in the details in how you follow through on some of the well-intended changes that are being implemented. So specifically what I'm talking about is under his efforts to try and reduce or minimize some of the traditional sentencing repercussions for the crimes that occur within our county, his implementation of several different programs, whether it's the RIDER program or decriminalizing drug charges. What our community is seeing is an uptick and a rise in certain unfortunate collateral consequences of that. And what I mean by that is, you know, Hillsborough County has long suffered from impaired driving. We've got unfortunately a horrific track record with loss of life as a result of drunk driving. The RIDER program that he implemented back in 2018, unfortunately, even though maybe it sounded good, you look at the number of fatalities occurring within our county over the last 2 years, and we're going in the wrong direction. His drug program to try to decriminalize the simple drug use, the possessions thing, because I think that it's easy to read the writing on the wall that as a society we're becoming less concerned, maybe, or more accepting of the notion that maybe marijuana use is one day going to be legal for all states. Who knows? That's for voters to decide. And so trying to make sure that folks that maybe just have a drug use problem or very minor drug possession charges, trying to make sure that they're not involved unnecessarily in the criminal justice system, I think makes perfect sense. But when that policy as it's implemented starts now resulting in individuals who have prolific criminal histories, including crimes of violence, including not just possession, but actual sale, delivery of narcotics, and we're still putting them back into that same system and allowing them to walk right back out the door with little to no repercussion, that gives me pause. And I look to the amount of gun violence and the homicides that we've had in the Hillsborough community, particularly in our at-risk communities, and something's not working right.
What about kids being charged as adults? That's something that has changed a lot in Hillsborough County. What's your position on that?
Well, I think that, again, as a basic premise, kids make poor decisions at various times in their life. I think I don't know a single kid that didn't do something foolish at that young age.
Didn't we all?
Absolutely. And the notion of not wanting a single bad act, or maybe even a couple bad acts, to prevent or become some dark cloud that looms over that youngster's life in perpetuity, who could argue against that? I mean, that's the whole notion. Let's keep kids out of the criminal justice system whenever and to whatever extent we can. But again, there's a limit now. And what I think you start to run a risk of if you become too complacent with the, oh, let's just go ahead and divert, is the same thing that anybody who's had children of their own, you start to wonder if you're creating an absentee parent situation where children who don't really ever experience repercussions for their bad behavior, particularly when that behavior is now starting to have a safety or a danger impact on the community they're living in, then what's going to modify the behavior?
One of the big problems in the criminal justice system, as I've covered it over the years, was that many people are mentally unstable, and they instituted a mental health court. How do you feel about that?
Long overdue, and I'm glad that we've made great progress in that direction. I as you're aware, I was a commander in our jails for a number of years here recently, and I can speak with intimate firsthand knowledge of the vast number of individuals who are in the jail system who suffer from significant mental health issues. At any given time while I was there, we averaged about 1/3 of our incarcerated population was on psychotropic medications. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't commit a crime. That doesn't mean that they weren't doing something that was perhaps putting others at danger. But it brings home the point that there is absolutely a portion of criminal conduct or misconduct that's occurring locally for us that is being driven by something other than a person's intent and design. And as much as we are capable of trying to identify those individuals and create an alternative that has the best chance of getting them some sort of assistance, relief, guidance, structure, whatever that might be, other than being in a jail, because jails are not designed. We know this, Mike. Jails are not designed to fix somebody who is suffering from a mental instability. We can stabilize. We can prevent deterioration if we're very good and lucky about it. But fixing has to happen at the community level from community-driven solutions. Because locking somebody up simply because they suffer from that illness is not something that anybody can be happy about.
You come from a long line of law enforcement, your grandfather, your father, you all in law enforcement, and the pendulum sometimes swings to, very pro-police, tough on crime, to now we're going through a sea change with the events of the past couple of weeks. How does that make the job more difficult for a prosecutor and a law enforcement officer? What is your stance on being, the tough on crime or the way that some society is clamoring for a change?
Well, I think that the change is long overdue. And I think that's some of the frustration that you're seeing from all sorts of angles. It's talk. There's been talk. There's been some minor improvement here or there. But until all interested parties, everybody who's got is a stakeholder in the process, is willing to sit down at a table and lay it all out. Here is where the system is initially running into an issue, and whether it starts in the community or in the resources being provided, particularly to our at-risk communities, and then translates into how police is involving itself in those communities and the nature of that relationship, or at this point, the lack thereof, right? Because if you've got a breakdown in communication and understanding and trust between your public servants, both police, prosecutor, judiciary, and so forth, and the very community you're supposed to be serving and protecting, right? If that relationship has diminished to the point where it's not there, okay, well, that's not a recipe for success. You can't effectively do anything either to support the one, protect the other, or bring about necessary improvements and change and build that trust back up without really reevaluating that. So whether you are a cop on the streets or a prosecutor or wear a robe and sit up on the bench or a decision maker at any level of local government, I think that you have to, at this point in time, be ready and equipped. And by equipped, I mean truly capable of speaking across what would be lines or borders between us and them and right and wrong. You have to be able to speak all the different languages and be capable of building consensus at this point in time to make the changes that are going to be necessary, because business as usual is not going to suffice anymore. You know, we need to be able to really take a hard look at whether or not, regardless of intent, whether or not police practices are culminating in disparate outcomes, whether across racial lines or across affluence lines, if you will. We need to take a hard look at whether or not the sentences or the offers or the manner in which cases are being prosecuted, again, an intent aside, are they culminating in outcomes that when you see the production that you've got there, oh my goodness, there's a racial disparity here that's arisen. And I think that some of the diversion efforts are a start. I think that the concern is if one party is just playing this role of doing diversion, no pros, drop, reduce, we're just going to handle it all over here, have you actually brought the other involved parties to the table so that they can be changing with you? Or are you just doing your own thing, your own dance? And everybody moving forward is going to have to learn to work as a team, which means trusting and believing in one another, because you're not going to do it without all the other parties agreeing that this is how it's going to be from now on. So I think for any politician that's been sitting in one of these seats for a number of years, they've got their work cut out for them. For somebody like me that's never been a politician, quite frankly, never had this lifelong burning urge to be seeking this type of position that I'm now looking for, it actually, I couldn't be more excited. The tragedy, you know, notwithstanding, because I hate that we're ripping each other apart right now, but I truly believe that I have the background, the empathy, the understanding of all the different components at stake to actually step in and make a difference and bring everybody along with me.
What was there something that you said that you haven't had a lifelong ambition to do this that pushed you over the edge? When did you all of a sudden say, I have got to do this?
When I transitioned from being in-house counsel in 2010 to being put in a commander role and being placed in charge of you know, hardworking men and women at the sheriff's office, you know, coming from a strictly civilian background, what I learned and what I grew to appreciate is the potential effect that one can have on raising the level of expectation on perhaps preventing bad outcomes or undesirable events by virtue of how you're able to get the folks that you're working with and for to believe in something and to not just be doing it because the SOP, the standard operating procedure, said go do this or don't go do this, but actually what's the right thing to do. What is about principle. It is about, here's your job, here's what you've been asked to do on this shift. It's not about what you can do, it's about what you should do. And if you walk into all of these arenas with that type of mentality about, I don't care what anybody did before, and I don't care how this might have been handled 2 days ago, 2 weeks ago, 2 years ago, given the facts we have right now, what is the best that we can do for everybody involved that will help keep us safe, keep the public safe, protect our, whether it's our inmates or this arrestee that we're coming into custody with. And I think that I got so much satisfaction out of that challenge and being responsible for both the good and the bad that can come out of there, because we're human, right? There's no guarantees of perfection. Mistakes will happen, errors will happen. I think that I found that very fulfilling, Mike. And once that opportunity has been there, it's really kind of, it creates a change within inside the person that has been given that, that amazing opportunity. And as I sat back now in the last couple of years and was hearing the frustration or the disappointment or the voices of people from all sides of the criminal justice equation right now, voicing their concerns about what they were experiencing and seeing happening, one day you wake up and you say, why not? I've been given a unique set of circumstances and experiences that I think would be very difficult to reproduce normally, and to the extent of, you know, attorney on one side, attorney on the other side, leader on of large groups of badge carrying people, understanding what law enforcement brings to the table, understanding the judges from my long-term relationships and friendships with so many of them. And if you're not going to try to make yourself available to the benefit of the community that you've grown up in and loved, then shut your mouth and crawl back in a hole, I guess is where it comes down to. I figured it was time to put up or shut up, so to speak.
Okay, I have one final question. One of the toughest jobs of the elected state attorney for any district is to determine a good or bad shooting by a police officer. It's tough because you work with those agencies all the time in trying to get the bad actors off of the street. Is it going to be tougher for you with your law enforcement background when you have to determine, and that's a big thing that has come up over the past couple of weeks, obviously, whether it's a good shooting or a bad shooting. How's that all going to play into everything?
Well, actually, I think that it actually plays toward my experience very well, because I'll be one of the first state attorneys, maybe in the history of things, that not only understands what the law says, but actually is acutely aware of what the training is for those law enforcement officers. And I understand what the expectations were and when and how that firearm was supposed to come out of the holster, and what the criteria were, and what the policies were or should have been about utilizing that firearm in those situations. So, you know, from square one, I guess I'll be able to walk into those very difficult and perhaps very tragic situations and have a keen eye on what did happen, perhaps what should have happened, what's ideal, what's less than ideal. And then to answer the heart of your question, will it be difficult? It'll be as gut-wrenching as every other adverse event that ever happens, whether it's involving one of our deputies or law enforcement officers or just one of our citizens. I mean, the loss of life or the potential taking of life is one of the most serious, one of the most potentially tragic, one of the most difficult moments that will ever happen in an individual person's life, whether you were the person who was shot or the person that did the shooting. And the fact that it's difficult and gut-wrenching is what demands that you give it the ultimate in attention and transparency. And that's where I do see, if I'm going to be honest about it, let's look across both the country, let's look across within our own state. Law enforcement agencies haven't always done a great job with that open, transparent discussion of it, because I get it. This is their employee that they've got police and Bill of Rights to worry about, and they've got their own due process to worry about, and they've got an admin investigation that's going on, perhaps concurrent with a criminal investigation. And it's very difficult. It's a very dynamic situation, but it is exactly at those moments that what you need are people capable of being true leaders when it's the hardest, right? When it requires the gut check, when it requires the most fortitude, right? Intestinal fortitude. That is that moment where when something looks inappropriate, man, call it like it is. Say it, be able to sit up and own it and take responsibility for your component of the decision-making. As a state attorney, you don't get to tell that agency what to do with their policies. You don't get to tell the legislators what to do with how they formulate the laws. But you do decide how your agency, in reviewing this activity, how you make that call or make that decision on that event. And I believe that is, as you already said, one of those key areas that every state attorney is going to have to be very front and center about and not pull punches and not worry about hurting feelings. Just say it. Do the job. Uphold the oath then as much as any other time.
So it clearly presents a difference between the two candidates. Mike has a different view than Andrew does. It'll be an interesting race, that's for sure. But again, we felt it was important to provide equal time anytime we have candidates on, and so that's why. But you've got a clear choice between the two candidates. There's no question about it.
And, you know, and we're going to continue with some dialogue, some more discussions. We're going to have some interesting people on the next couple of weeks. You know, because we think it's important, again, this is, you know, that fighting for racial equality and fighting for justice is a Jewish value. So Mike and I will continue to have discussions related to that over the next few weeks as we, you know, as a nation, we continue to work on healing and moving forward. So I think that's important. Lots of, but you know, Mike, as always, there's so much that we haven't gotten to this week. how about Fiddler on the Roof?
Oh yeah, that is amazing. The thought was, up until COVID-19, that Fiddler on the Roof was performed every night somewhere in the United States since the 60s, you know? I can't believe if you're Jewish, you've never seen a production of Fiddler on the Roof. I mean, it just seems so much part of our culture.
And it's classic. But you know what I love about Fiddler on the Roof? It does speak to so many people. I mean, the fact that in April, May, it was supposed to be, you know, doing a 3-city tour in China. I mean, of all places, but it's so universal, that the struggle and the hopes and the dreams. I mean, I think it just speaks universally to so many cultures and so many people. So they say that they believe it's the first time in 50 years that it is not on a stage somewhere in the world.
Yeah.
Our
life has changed so much because of COVID-19, and some of it will never come back. Fiddler will, come back once again and tour again once we have theater. But I mean, the theaters are all dark.
Yes. Throughout. Wait, by the way, it's true, and I got, because I know we have a minute left. I got to mention this because I almost forgot, and I can't wait because I've got I'm making a list. I'm checking it twice. Why? Because we've got the Jewish Film Festival is about to start here in Tampa.
So oh, yeah.
I'm really excited about that. So I promise you, I will have, and they're doing it, which is really cool. So, you know, obviously we can't do it in the theaters this year. So, and it's done through the Federation. So we're going to be doing it virtually. So you'll be able to log in. And so I'm really excited about being able to watch a couple movies, which I promise you I will report back.
Yes, you will. You are our entertainment reporter, you know. But no, and that's so good because it was sad. They had a great lineup of films. And then obviously we couldn't go to the theaters and see them. You know, like I say, life has changed so much for all of us.
Yes.
And I
will report back on my favorites.
Yeah, I am sure you watch more documentaries than almost anybody I know. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that, and I know how hard they worked to put that together, and how disappointed they were when it had to be canceled. But speaking of canceled, well, it's not canceled, but you know what that music means? It means we have run out of time. Thanks for being with us. Happy Father's Day if you're listening to this on Sunday. This is The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorene Chaffee. Happy Father's Day.
Bye.
That's this week's Third Opinion. We hope you enjoyed it. If you have comments or suggestions, head on over to thirdopinionpodcast.com. Remember to like and follow the Third Opinion Podcast on Facebook, and do not forget to subscribe to the Third Opinion Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Until next week, thanks for listening.